Welcome to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
Soviet culture in transition, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations with three scholars of Eastern European literature. I'll talk with Alex Zolkovsky of the University of Southern California, Helena Gostillo of the University of Pittsburgh, and Thomas Lahusen of Duke University. We'll begin with Alex Zolkovsky discussing the evolution of Russian literature from the 19th into the 20th century. After that, Helena Gostillo and Thomas Lahusen will talk about the effects of political totalitarianism on Soviet literature. Soundings will conclude this week with commentary by Donald Rawley, a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Alex Zolkovsky is at work on a series of rereadings of Russian literary history. I asked him to reflect on 19th century Russian writers like Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, and to compare them with European counterparts, like the English novelist Charles Dickens. Alex Zolkovsky.
Well, maybe there is an overstatement in the way you are opposing the two centuries.
All right.
Actually, as you pointed to Dickens, Dickens not only wrote novels that read enthrallingly, but he very much invested in bettering society, taking care of the prison systems and things like that. And this didactic element in Dickens is what is very similar to what we have in Russian literature beginning somewhere in the middle of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
Such writers as Gogol and then Tolstoy, to name Dostoevsky certainly, and Chernyshevsky, who is not as very well known in the West, but is an important voice in Russian literature, and many others. And in general, Russian literature as a whole assumed what is known in Russia as the role of the second or shadow government.
Uh-huh.
The cultural situation in Russia was a cultural political situation was characterized by the virtual absence of parliamentary institutions, of the channels for the voice, for the dissenting voice, for the voice of evolutionary change. It was an autocratic system. So the twist was that Russian literature in the 20th century, this as Soviet literature, continued in this political mode, but under the Soviet rule, it became the mouthpiece not of the protesting, dissenting voice, but of the official voice. True, the Communist Party claimed to be the inheritor, to be an heir to the opposition, leftist, etc., thinking and political activities of the past. But actually what happened under Stalin, that it made an about-face and became the oppressive, newly autocratic totalitarian regime, which inherited more from the czars than from the czars' victims.
Uh-huh. I understand that there is a large bureaucracy of editors, censors might be another word for this class of aesthetic participants in the Soviet Union, people who look out for the political correctness of what the artists are producing. Talk to me for a moment about that.
Well, of course, there was a vast system of police and secret police, political police. Then there were the censors. Then, as milder forms, there were the prize-awarding agencies. And then there was this institution, which is very well known in the Russian cultural establishment as self-censorship.
Self-censorship.
That's where the writers, be it by getting together and passing resolutions on how they should write, what socialist realism is about, or just in the privacy of their studio, as they are writing, were themselves correcting themselves, striking out whatever might seem not only dissident, but possibly just not acceptable enough, not not fawning enough.
Mm-hmm.
It's no chance. Let me go back to what I said. Stalin was awarding Stalin's prizes. He took great care of all the arts. He was very attentive to the arts.
Setting the ground rules.
Yeah, because he was the supreme artist of that whole land turned into an artistic performance.
In other words, the person who shapes the landscape, regardless of whether it's cultural or political. Alex Zolkovsky, what about the artistic freedom of the Russian writer, the Russian artist here in the early 1990s? Has the status of that individual changed as dramatically as the status of politics, as politics seems to have changed in the Soviet Union?
Well, let me approach this from somewhat afar. We mentioned this dissident or alternative voice in Russian literature, even under the Soviets. And several concepts are important. Of course, all open dissent was impossible. People were just shot or sent to Siberia, or first one or the other in some order. But some dissenting voices did exist there in the shape of what is known as Aesopian writing.
Aesopian,
like in Aesop, the Greek fable writer.
Uh-huh.
Aesopian writing, which pretends to toe the official line, but actually smuggles into the text with a wink to the understanding reader.
Heavily
smuggles,
laced with irony, in other
not
words.
Not heavily. Lightly. Lightly laced.
To the reader, perhaps.
It winks to the reader in a very slight, very subtle way, because otherwise the censor will pick this up.
Bingo.
Yeah. So in a sense, much of the suppressed writing was not really suppressed in the sense it was not published, but it was self-suppressing or self-repressing.
Mm-hmm.
Talk again about this self-censorship, but in this case, self-censorship with a difference, where you try to smuggle things past the censor.
Has the situation opened up now? I mean, are we past this Aesopian kind of writing?
Definitely, but let me mention another aspect of the writing of the 30s, 50s, and through 50s under Stalin. That was the writing which was not published. It existed there in the drawer, as they say. They were writing for the drawer. And then after Stalin's death, it came to be known. And many masterpieces came to be known, and some of them have been translated since into English, something like Mikhail Bulgakov's Master and Margarita is one of the paperbacks in this country, for instance. Platonov is another writer like that. And so on. But with the advent of glasnost quite recently in the 1985 or 6, the situation really changed. It has become practically a free for all.
Mm-hmm.
And all the dissenting voices can find their expression. They can find their expression in magazines, journals, newspapers, less on TV, which is centrally managed. As a result, literature, serious writing, is now freed, released from this task of being necessarily the voice of the opposition.
I remember interviewing one of your compatriots, a man named Boris Karkalitsky, and I asked him if he was free to write whatever he wanted, and he said, sure, I'm free to write it, but I can't publish it. He says, I'm more widely read in Italy and France and in Germany than I am in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, he's one of those quite intransigent oppositional voices, uncompromising, but I think that now he can publish freely.
Uh-huh.
One could discuss to what extent now it's folding this freedom. What are the elements of new censorship on the central television and so on and so forth? But basically, artistic literature is now free from the task of being the denunciatory voice.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, there is a new generation of writers who insist on there being artists, creators of aesthetic objects, not laden, not given in advance this task of being also crusaders for some political views. And this is a completely new departure in Soviet literature of the 70 years.
Alex Zolkovsky, what is your responsibility as a Russian emigre, as a one who is intimate with Russian language and culture, and yet who looks at it from the shores of California, writes about Russian culture and literature? What is your responsibility to your homeland?
Well, I would say it is twofold, because on the one hand, I'm Russian here, and on the other hand, I'm American there,
uh-huh.
especially now that I can travel back and forth.
Indeed.
So while I'm here, what I'm trying to do is to write about Russian literature in a scholarly way and also in a less
highbrow ways in journals and other publications like that, sometimes in English, many times in Russian. And both disseminate, discuss, analyze, and so on and so forth, Russian literature. And also sometimes try to help the emigre writers in their very difficult careers in this country where dissemination of their work and getting it supported is a problem. When I go over there, I am rather an emissary of the Western literary critical thought, attitudes, and so on and so forth, in maybe in two senses. One of them being somebody who is exposed to Western literary theories. Another is somebody who, not being part of the oppressive, or until very recently oppressive, Soviet scene, is less politically engaged and as a result, in a sense, more free to discuss with more deliberation the literary problems than some of the Soviet critics who would have been my comrades in arms earlier, because they were the dissidents, I was a dissident, and the main thrust was to oppose the repressive monolithic regime and thinking. And now I feel that I am one of those who are focusing more on the more objective, many-sided, pluralistic approach to the literary situation, rather than being a crusader.
Alex Zolkovsky teaches at the University of Southern California. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a series of rereadings of Russian literary history. The program is Soundings, Conversations and Commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Soviet Culture in Transition continues now with a discussion featuring two other experts in Eastern European literature. You'll hear next from Helena Goschillo of the University of Pittsburgh and Thomas Lahusen of Duke University. I asked them to describe the evolution of Russian literature from the 19th into the 20th century. I also asked them to comment on the relation between communism and literature in what used to be the Soviet Union. Thomas Lahusen.
What happened to, I mean, I'm very glad that you are using the word what happened to communism and not only what happened to literature. Well, what happened to communism is something which happens right to us, I mean, right now, that the great other, the great enemy, which defines us in a certain way, is vanishing. And at the same time, the great model, Dostoevsky, the great other, I mean, Tolstoy, the great exotic, is vanishing. And maybe we are in this no man's land, in this cultural, political no man's land, that we have to restructure our culture, but also the culture of the other.
Do we talk simply in terms of censorship when we talk about what happened to Soviet literature before the rise of communism and after the rise of communism? Surely the presence of the Communist Party didn't entirely stifle creativity. It did something to it, but what?
Well, you know, you'll be surprised, because there are some writers who have been saying recently that precisely the presence of censorship helped some talents to flourish.
Elaborate that
yes.
thought for me.
Well, you know, we were talking about this a little bit earlier when the three of us were speaking, is that, for example, somebody like Sinyavsky found his greatest freedom in prison. Okay, and Dostoevsky discovered boundless waves and depths of spirituality in himself, he felt, and in Russian society while he was in prison. It has been said by various writers, Tatiana Tolstoy spoke about this recently, in passing at least, how the presence of censorship in a funny way seemed to have tested a person's abilities of still saying whatever she or he wanted to say, saying creatively, vividly, right, and finding maybe a voice which was a much more complex voice, let us say, than the voice would have been in a country without censorship. Right now, I think, what we have is very clear ideology having been replaced by what I call dollarology.
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 What do you mean, the worship of the West?
I think that, whereas before, ideology was very clearly defined in the Soviet Union. One could tell which writer thought what, which writer was associated with what. Mm-hmm. I think you could map out various allegiances. I think right now the economic factor, both in the country in general and the economic factor in the production of culture, has become so important that I think that the money issue is penetrating all kinds of areas which had not been penetrated before.
Wouldn't this necessarily, I don't know if that's the right word, wouldn't this invite a wonderful, magnificent artistic response? Don't writers love to take on these large economic issues where the country is, going
sure
down the tube?
I'm not sure that economics is a kind of, a topic or a spur to literary production at all. I think...
How about Marxism? Isn't that a word that hovers in many conversations? No. Doesn't that lead to...
I think it's a word that hovers in conversations, but do you think... I mean, I think it's a mistake to assume that Marxism per se inspires literature. Uh-huh. Of course it does not. Okay. And my view is that right now we in the West, just like Soviets there, keep on referring to the current situation as chaotic. I agree with Thomas. I think politics does not go away. But I think the political picture right now is much muddier than it was before. Do you agree, Thomas?
How about this?
I don't know if I would really agree with this, because I think that, in fact, politics was there, and believe in Marxism, believe in the state, believe in something called socialist realism, was always there, but was always a fake. At least since the end of the 30s. Maybe at the beginning of the 30s, writers were still believing in what they did, in what they did right in their positions. But from then on, it was just a matter of survival, how to survive in such a system.
Thomas Lahusen, when a Russian writer thinks about his or her responsibility to the society, surely that can't be monolithic. I mean, writers hang around together, they talk to one another, they share their concerns, but they don't all get together and vote and say, this is what we're going to take on and this is what we're going to endorse. What about the sort of personal latitude that a Russian writer has vis-a-vis all of these political changes that are occurring so rapidly in that society?
I think the Soviet writer right now, as far as I can judge, has a tremendous difficulty, because he has been living since the beginning of the Soviet regime, in a constant, in a very strange world. There is a quite good history book called Utopia u vlasti. Helena, how would you translate this in English?
Well, I call it Utopia.
Yes, I guess Utopia in the grip of power.
Not in the grip, but Utopia, which is actually in power.
Yes.
Maybe just Utopia in power.
In power, yes, I guess.
And Utopia in power. So how, Soviet society and writers have been in this fake reality, in this utopian reality. So how can they react to suddenly a change, a brutal change? They're still in this reality in terms. So I think it's very difficult to answer for them. But I think we should give them time. And I think once again, they should have some time to not be responsible and to play, exactly.
Well, again, not to trivialize, before our taping session, Helena Gostillo quoted from Janis Joplin, freedom is just another word for... How does that line go?
Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose.
And is that the situation that Russian writers find themselves in now?
I think, I wish it were to some extent, though in other words... In some ways, I don't. I don't think Russian writers are free right now, unfortunately. I think right now Russian writers, like everyone else in the country, are being tormented in many ways, I think, by just the everyday concerns of life.
Surviving the society.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think having enough to eat for your family, which really is a bona fide question. Prices on some things have gone up 235%.
Yeah.
I think just that kind of question really... makes the question of play seem frivolous, though I do agree with Thomas that the ludic element in Russian culture has been denied for a sadly, sadly long time and has affected all aspects of life.
I agree with you, Helena, and it might be contradictory what I will say now, but I think that indeed there is a responsibility of a country which at one time is... going into what I would call the McDonaldization of of a society. On the other hand,
McDonaldization.
The McDonald. Yeah, okay,
fair enough.
Of the society, but also of a whole society and a system, but also the if I can, if this is possible to say, the third worldization.
Yes.
But that's why, once again, the old Gogolian claim for the stern meaning still remains important. And there were two great writers for me, Pushkin and Gogol. And Gogol maybe would be the great synthesist, or the great synthesis of Soviet, Russian and world problems. The stern meaning and the irony and the grotesque.
Helena Gostiello teaches at the University of Pittsburgh, Thomas Lahusen at Duke University. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Helena Gostiello worked on a project about contemporary fiction by Soviet women. Her anthology of Soviet literature under Gorbachev is available from Artist Publishers. The program is Soundings, Conversations and Commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Soviet Culture in Transition concludes now with the comments of Donald Raleigh, a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Donald Raleigh was in the Soviet Union during the recent and failed political coup. I asked him to reflect on popular culture in Soviet society.
As an historian whose research interests focus on provincial Russia, I had the good fortune of spending a month during the August Revolution of 1991 in the provincial capital of Saratov, a city that's been closed to generations of Western scholars. Saratov has a population of approximately 1 million. It's located on the Volga River, some 450 miles southeast of Moscow. The purpose of my visit was to conduct research in archives that were long closed to me and to other foreigners. But I had the opportunity as well to observe local society firsthand. This is important not only because few foreigners have made their way to Saratov, but even more so because of the bias in Western scholarship and in our media coverage of the Soviet Union. Both have sought to analyze this vast patchwork of a country from the vantage point of Moscow, St. Petersburg, and a handful of other towns. What I'd like to do here is to comment in brief on the impact of both glasnost and perestroika on what we might call popular culture along the shores of the Volga. My major observation is that society has had a rough time searching for real values. We must take into account the fact that every single element of the old belief system that held the country together has been shattered. As a result, local society suffers from a real crisis of confidence as it searches desperately for something to believe in. The spiritual vacuum is being filled with a nostalgic, an often uncritical and ahistorical interest in the past, with a revival in religious activity and other phenomena that help people secure their moorings. Regarding interest in the past, there is an ongoing rejection of everything associated with Soviet power and curiosity about everything that has been denied, destroyed, or falsified. Now, it's unimportant whether this was the result of revolutionary euphoria or later of conscious manipulation of the truth. All of the old villains are heroes, or at least topics of interest. For example, the czars are in, the commissars are out. American-style democracy is to rage, not a sociologically defined one. A market economy, which few understand, is the order of the day, not a planned economy. The once forbidden still titillates. Pornography is a good example. The spiritual vacuum in the country is not only being filled by religion, but also by popular interest in astrology, in the occult, yoga, homeopathy, extrasensory perception, and Soviet Gene Dixons. Rare is the newspaper these days without an astrological column. Finally, I would note that the long-term historical fascination with America has taken on new forms. American movies, for instance, are the rage of the day. Now, I'm not speaking here of highbrow cinema, but of Sylvester Stallone, Arnold Schwarzenegger, American shootouts, and horror movies. In fact, Soviet directors have recently complained about this phenomenon. Now that they're free to do as they please, they've bombarded their viewers with films about what I euphemistically called the excesses of the Stalin era. As a result, they've lost their audience. People simply have had enough. What this suggests, of course, is a psychological need to escape the grim realities of everyday life, hence the avid interest in heroes who exude strength, vigor, vitality, and a phoenix-like ability to rise from the ashes. At the same time, however, I can't help but think that there's an uncanny similarity between the positive didactic hero of socialist realism, which was once mandatory viewing in the Soviet Union, and the American equivalent, with all the appeal of Hollywood glitz, now viewed voluntarily. Now, these are just a few of the many examples that come to mind. When Gorbachev returned to Moscow after the attempted coup had failed, he said something like this: "This is a different people and a different country than it was a week ago, and I see both the past and the future with different eyes now." I think Gorbachev is right. The time is propitious for us to examine the country from fresh perspectives, not only by looking beyond the confines of the capitals, but also by studying with interest everyday people out in the provinces.
Donald Raleigh is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He was in the Soviet Union during the recent and failed political coup. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Donald Raleigh is at work on a study of Russian provincial history. The program is Soundings, Conversations, and Commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Soviet Culture in Transition is available on cassette. For a copy of this program, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 588. That's program number 588. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings.
You've been listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Next week, Dispatches from the South. Wayne Pond will talk with Douglas Cater, President Emeritus of Washington College, and with John Shelton Reed of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Douglas Cater will discuss his book about Lyndon Johnson. John Reed will discuss his book, Whistling Dixie, A Guide to the South for Non-Southerners. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join us again next week at this time on this radio station. Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Soviet Culture in Transition, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. The evolution of Russian writing from the 19th into the 20th century and the impact of totalitarianism on Russian literature. Listen for discussion on those topics by scholars from the University of Pittsburgh, Duke University, and the University of Southern California. Soviet Culture in Transition, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.